Chapter 8. It was from the mizzen top that they first saw this island, or rather the little isolated flat cloud that marked its presence. So many leagues, so many degrees of longitude had passed under the Surprise's keel that now, patiently taught by Bondon, the medicos came up by the futtock shrouds like Christians. And for the last fortnight they'd done so without attendance, without lifelines or anything to break a headlong fall, although reaching the top in this, the seaman's way, entailed climbing what was in effect a rope ladder, inclined some 55 degrees from the vertical, 55 degrees backwards, so that one hung like a sloth gazing at the sky. Their movements were not unlike those of a sloth either, but both confessed that this was a far more compendious method and far more agreeable than their former writhing through the tightly clustered rigging. And they were not displeased at hearing Pullings say, in the course of a dinner at which the gunroom was entertaining the captain, that the Surprise was the only ship he'd ever known in which both the doctors went aloft without using the lubber's hole. Yet though they had made such progress, and though the ship had advanced so far eastwards, they had not yet exhausted Martin's South American observations. He was still engaged with his particular part of the Amazonian forest, with its extraordinary floor of dead vegetation, huge fallen trees lying across one another, so that in some places there was a great depth of rotting wood, and a man had to choose the most recent, hardly discernible sometimes because of the dense clothing of lianas, and soundest trunk, in order not to fall 20 and even 30 feet into a chaos of decay. Twilight at noonday in those deeper parts, and almost devoid of mammals, birds, all high, high above in the sunlit tops, and even reptiles, but oh, matcher, and what a wealth of beetles! Nor had they done more than touch upon some aspects of Java, with Pulo Prabang still to come, though the birdskins and the deeply interesting footbones of Tapirus indicus had been shown, when they heard the cry of "Land ho!" from the lookout, high above them on the main topmast crosstrees. "Land 1 point on the larboard bow!" The cry cut their conversation short. It also cut short many a quiet natter in the waist or on the forecastle, for this was during the afternoon watch of a make and mend day, and many of the younger, more ardent Surprises flung down their needles, thread, thimbles and ditty bags. They ran eagerly aloft, crowding the upper yards and shrouds. They made way for Oakes, however, since, as the lightest and nimblest of those who walked the quarter-deck, he had been sent up to the jack itself with a telescope. "I have it, sir," he called down. "I have it on the top of the rise. Green, with a broad rim of white, about 5 leagues, almost exactly to leeward, just under that little cloud." Jack and Tom Pullings smiled at one another. This was as pretty a landfall as could be wished, and although each had independently fixed the ship's position by several excellent lunars these last few days, as well as by the ship's 2 chronometers, neither had supposed that they could reach Sweeting's Island without altering course by more than 0.5 point, and that within 2 or 3 hours of the predicted time. "The sails are in the way," said Martin, "and we're too low down. Don't you think that by climbing higher still, say to the mizzen cross-trees above this frustrating topsail, we might get a better view?" "I do not," said Stephen. "And even if we did, would a wise, prudent man, with a duty towards his patience, creep to that dizzy height for a nearer view of an island that we shall walk upon with the blessing tomorrow itself, or even this very evening? An island that promises little to the natural philosopher, for you are to consider that these very small, very remote little islands don't possess the superficies for anything considerable in the way of flora or fauna peculiar to themselves. Do but think of the shocking paucity of land birds in Tahiti, so very much greater in mass. Banks remarked upon it with sorrow, almost with reprehension. No, sir. As I understand it, Sweeting's Island is of value to the medical man in search of antiscorbutics rather than to the philosopher. And you'll allow me to say that I wonder at your impatience. It arises from a humbler cause altogether. Though in passing I may observe that St. Kilda has a wren of its own and the Orkneys a vole mouse. The fact of the matter is that I'm not so truly amphibious a creature as you or Captain Aubrey. Though few people would believe it, I am essentially a landsman, descended no doubt from Antaeus, and I long to set foot on land again, to draw new strength from it, to withstand the next few months of oceanic life. I long to walk upon a surface that is not in perpetual motion, rolling, pitching, liable to catch me unawares with a lee lurch and fling me into the scuppers while my friends call out butcher and the sailors hide their mirth. I don't think I'm discontented with my lot, Maturin, I beg. I'm passionately fond of long sea voyages and all the charming possibilities that may ensue. The flame tree on the banks of San Francisco, the vampires at Penedo itself. But from time to time, I long to sit on my native element, the earth, from which I rise like a giant refreshed, ready to face a close-reefed topsail blow or the sickening reek of the orlop in the damp, oppressive heat of the doldrums with no breath of air and the ship rolling her masts out. It seems to me an age since I sat in a chair that could be trusted. For although we've passed many and many an island in our crossing of this enormous expanse of ocean, we did most emphatically pass them. Contrary winds and vexing currents had made us late for our various rendezvous. The only hope was this last one, and Captain Pullings drove the ship in a most pitiless manner. Harsh words, peremptory orders, no longer the modest, amiable young man we knew, but a sea-going budgerzet. And, of course, with no thought of stopping, even if sulphur-crested cassowaries had been seen on shore. But tell me, Maturin, is Wheatings Island indeed so very poor and barren? I've never even heard of it. Nor heaven knows had I until Captain Aubrey spoke its name. 'Twas a cousin on his mother's side discovered it, Admiral Carteret, who sailed round the world with Byron and then again with Wallace, but this time as captain of the Swallow, a rather small ship that became separated from Wallace in thick weather off Tierra del Fuego. Not, I believe, without a certain glee on the part of Carteret, since it allowed him to discover countries of his own, including this island, which he named after the midshipman who first sighted it. It was no Golconda, nor even a Tahiti, being inhabited by a surly, burly, ill-favoured set of naked black men with deep-set eyes, filed teeth, receding chins, and a great mop of coarse, frizzled black hair dyed, more or less successfully, light brown or yellow. They spoke no recognisable dialect of the Polynesian language, and it was thought they were more nearly related to the Papuans. We're never to see the shores of Papua, it appears, said Martin with a sigh, but I beg pardon, I interrupt. Nor we are. As I understand it, the captain's intention, for reasons to do with wind and current and tortuous navigation in the Torres Strait, was to leave New Guinea far on the right hand, strike away into the main ocean as far as this Sweetings Island, there refresh, and then turn down to bring us to the region of the southeast trades, and so, sailing on a bowline in which the Surprise excels all other ships, slant down to Sydney Cove, blue water sailing almost all the way, which he loves beyond anything. Nor does he mean to touch at the Solomon, still less to go inside the Great Barrier Reef or anywhere near it. They both shook their heads sadly, and Stephen went on. From what Sir Joseph told me of New Guinea, it's no great loss. He and Cook went ashore, wading through a vast extent of mud to an indifferent strand, where, without a word, the natives instantly set upon them, firing off what appeared to be crackers, calling out in the most offensive way and throwing spears. He only had time to collect 23 plants, none of them really interesting. And as for the Barrier Reef, I do not wonder at our shunning it after Cook's dreadful experiences. That's not to say I don't regret the necessity. It wounds my heart. Perhaps the wind may drop so that we can reach some part of the barrier by boat. I hope so, indeed. particularly at that island from the top of which Cook and Banks surveyed a vast expanse of the reef, and on which Banks collected some of the many lizards. But to return to Sweeting's Island, and now I believe I can make out a slight nick on the horizon, Captain Carter had found no gold dust, no precious stones, and no very amiable inhabitants, but he did find a considerable wealth of coconuts, yams, taro, and fruit of various kinds. There was only one village, for although there is reasonably fertile land inshore, the people make the greater part of their living from the sea, and they congregate in the island's single cove. All its other sides are more or less sheer too, and I imagine it's an ancient volcanic upheaval, or conceivably a sunken, degraded crater. In any event, disagreeable though the people looked and uninviting, they were induced to trade, and Captain Carteret came away with stores that kept his people in health until the Straits of Macassar. He fixed its position with the utmost care and took soundings. But it is very far from being a well-known island. And although Captain Aubrey tells me that far-ranging South Sea whalers sometimes call, I do not remember to have seen it on any map. "Perhaps it's inhabited by sirens," said Martin. "My dear Martin," said Stephen, who could be as obtuse as 10 upon occasion, "a moment's reflection will tell you that all the Sirenia require shallow water and great beds of seaweed, and that the only members of that inoffensive tribe found in the Pacific are stellar sea cow in the far north and the dugong in the more favoured parts of New Holland and the South China Sea. I have no hopes of anything but green stuff and fresh fruit. Which reminds me, will you sup with us tonight? We are to eat a mango preserve." Again Martin excused himself. And late that evening, when the mango preserve was finished and they were sitting down to their music, Stephen said, "Jack, I ask this perhaps impertinent question only to save myself from uttering unwelcome invitations. Is there disharmony between you and Martin?" "Heavens, no. What makes you imagine such a thing?" "I've sometimes asked him to sup with us, and he has always declined. He'll soon be out of plausible excuses." "Oh," said Jack, laying down his bow and considering. "It's true I cannot forget he's a parson, so I have to take care what I say. And then again, I hardly know what to say in any case. I've a great respect for Martin, of course, and so have the people, but I find him hard to talk to, and I may seem a little reserved. I cannot rattle away to a learned man as I can to you and Tom Pullings. That's to say, I don't mean you're not as learned as Job, far from it, upon my word and honour, but we have known one another so long. No, Martin and I have never had a cross word, which is just as well, because it's very unpleasant to be shut up for an indefinite period with someone you dislike. Much worse in the gunroom, of course, where you have to see his goddamn face every single day. But quite bad enough in the cabin, too, though some captains don't seem to mind. Perhaps he feels I've neglected him. I shall ask him to dinner tomorrow." Tomorrow. And the Surprise stood in for Sweeting's Island with the breeze 2 points above the beam. She had lain to all through the middle and much of the morning watch, for although Jack Aubrey had his cousin's chart and soundings clear in his mind, conditions might have changed since 1768, and he wanted clear light for the passage into the lagoon. He had it now, as he sat there, comfortably filled with breakfast, conning the ship from the foretopsail yard. The sun had climbed 45 degrees into the perfect eastern sky, and it was sending its light well down into the clear water, so clear that he saw the flash of a turning fish far below, perhaps 50 fathoms. There was nothing else to see, no hint of bottom. And according to Admiral Carteret's chart, there would be none until they were within musket shot of the reef, the shore being so very steep too. The ship was standing in for a typical passage through the reef, with a typical lagoon beyond. This was slack water. The breeze was steady. The ship had plenty of steerage way under fore topsail alone. She was pointing just so, with an allowance for her trifling leeway. And he had plenty of time to survey reef, broad and thickly set with coconut palms, lagoon and island. Not one of those slightly domed islands made of coral sand that he'd seen often enough in the East and South Sea, but a more rocky affair altogether, with a mass of trees and undergrowth, a variegated and often vivid green rising in a steep semicircle immediately behind the village on its crescent above high water mark, and both sending back the brilliant morning light. A fairly typical village, with canoes ranged on the sand. But most of the space was taken up by one very long house built on stilts, of a kind that he'd not seen before. He also had time to survey the frigate's decks. They were even more beautifully clean than usual, and had been since sunset. And everything was in the most exact order, with all falls flemished and what brass she possessed outshining gold, for it was possible that the king of this island might be asked aboard. Yet, even so, a good many foremast jacks, and not only young ones either, had found leisure to put on their shore-going rig, broad-brimmed sennit hats with surprise on the flowing band, embroidered shirts, snowy duck trousers with ribbons sewn along their outer seams, and small shining pumps with bows. For the surprise, manned solely by volunteers, was extraordinarily generous with liberty. Most of them had already arranged little bags full of nails, bottles, and pieces of looking-glass, since everyone knew how presents of this kind had pleased the young women of Tahiti, and this too was a South Sea island. They'd been in the great South Sea, as sailors reckoned it, ever since they crossed the 160th degree of eastern longitude. And whatever the doctor might say, all hands, apart from a few miserable old buggers like Flood the cook, whose brother had been eaten in the Solomons, confidently expected sirens. And there on the forecastle stood the two medicos, Stephen looking as eagerly at the island as Martin, although he'd cried down its potentialities. Yet there was something not quite right about the village. No movement at all, apart from the gentle waving of the palms. The canoes were all beached, none on the lagoon, none to be seen offshore. The sound of the breakers, the moderate breakers, on the reef grew louder. Jack called down to the men in the chains, "Hooper, carry on, Crook, carry on." "Aye, aye, sir," came the two voices, starboard very hoarse and deep, larboard shrill. A pause, then the splashes well out and ahead, and the alternating voices, "No bottom with this line! No bottom with this line! No bottom!" The entrance was clear ahead, and the water turned more green than blue. "Come up the sheet of fathom," called Jack. "Port half a spoke, steady. Steady thus." "Steady it is, sir." "By the mark, 18, came from the starboard chains.
"By the deep, 19,
from larboard. "Port a spoke," said Jack, seeing a pallor ahead. "Port a spoke it is, sir." Now they were well into the passage, with the reef and its palm trees high on either hand. The breeze was now on the beam, and abruptly the sound of the sea breaking on the outer side and the answering sigh of its long withdrawal was cut off. The ship moved on in silence, the leads going on either side, the occasional slight changes of course. Apart from these calls and the cry of a turn, nothing. A silence on deck until she was well into the lagoon, when she came up into the wind and dropped anchor. No sound from the shore.
Are you coming, Doctor? Asked Jack.
Both medicos had run along the gangway the moment the boat was lowered, and they were standing there, hung about with collecting cases, boxes, nets.
If you please, sir, said Dr. Maturin, it is our clear duty to look for anti-scorbutics at once.
Jack nodded, and while muskets, presents, and the usual trade goods were handing down the side, he said in a low voice, Doesn't this island seem strangely quiet to you?
It does.
And almost uninhabited. Yet three sharp-eyed men have separately assured us that they have seen people moving on the fringe of greenery. Young women in grass skirts. Perhaps they're assembled in the grove for some religious ceremony, said Martin. Nothing more numinous than a grove, as the ancient Hebrews knew.
Bondon, cover those muskets with the stern-sheets apron, called Jack, and turning aft, Mr. West, carry out a kedge and keep a broadside on.
Two guns to be drawn and fired blank if there are signs of trouble. Ball wide of us if I hold up my hand. Grape if they pursue the boat in their canoes. Carry on, Mr. Reed.
By this time, Reed had become wonderfully adept at getting about with only one arm, but there was a nest of anxious hands stretched out below to catch him if he fell. A nest that remained almost as kind and far more reasonable when the medical men made their descent, followed by the captain.
Shove off! Give way! Piped Reed. All together now, if you can manage it. And, Davis, you row dry for once.
These were the last words as they pulled across the lagoon, the officers looking thoughtfully at the silent shore.
"Row them all!" cried Reed at last,
and the bargemen tossed their oars into the boat navy fashion. A moment's glide, and the bows ground up into the sand. Bow oar jumped out to lay the gangplank, and Jack and the officers stepped ashore.
"He were about stern on, just afloat to a grapnel," said Jack. "Wilkinson, James and Parfitt to be boatkeepers this tide. The muskets out of sight. The rest come up the beach with me. No straggling until I give the word."
Up the white sand, their eyes half closed against the glare, but still looking expectantly right and left at the canoes, the woods and the long, long house. And in spite of orders, Reed, somewhat behind the main group, went skipping away to the canoes. Some moments later, as a hog rushed from behind the nearest canoe and into the trees, he came running back. He looked pale yellow under his tan, and he said to Stephen, "There's something horrible there. A woman, I think." The party stopped and looked at him. In a faltering voice, he added, "Dead."
"Will you wait for me here, sir, without going on?" said Stephen.
And there they stood uneasy while he walked away, followed by Martin. In this brilliant light, the silence was all the more oppressive. All round the group they turned their questioning faces to one another, but never a word, not even in an undertone, until the doctor, coming back, called from a distance,
"Sir! All the men who have not had the smallpox should return to the boat at once."
And coming up, he asked, "Mr. Reed, have you had the smallpox?"
"No, sir."
"Then take off your clothes. Go bathe in the sea, wet your hair through and through, and sit by yourself in the front of the boat. Touch no one. Who has a tinderbox?"
"Here, sir," said Bondon. "Then pray strike a light and burn Mr. Reed's clothes. You have had the disease, sir, as I recall."
"Yes, when I was a child," said Jack. And to the men who were standing somewhat apart, "Johnson, Davies and Hedges, you go back to the boat." They turned, touching their foreheads, and walked down the slope, their faces disappointed, but above all troubled. And a charnel house eddy followed them as far as the sea.
"And all the rest of you?" asked Stephen. "Make sure now, for this is the wicked and confluent kind."
Another man fell out, muttering something and hanging a shameful head.
"Now, sir, as you look into the longhouse, And then perhaps we can search for our anti-scorbutics. The hands had better stay here for a while. Do you choose to come, sir?
Jack walked deliberately after Stephen and Martin, hating each step. He expected something very unpleasant, repulsive. But what he saw and what he breathed as he followed them up the ladder and into the buzzing twilight of the long house was far, far worse. Almost the entire village had died there.
"It's no good we can do here," said Stephen, having walked up and down the whole length twice with the closest attention.
And when they were outside on the raised platform with its pyramid of ancestral skulls, the lower tiers moss green, he observed, "You were in the right of it, Mr. Martin, when you spoke of a religious ceremony. And these," pointing at two hatchets, new but for a little rust, lying on what had recently been a bed of flowers, "these, I believe, were the sacrifice offered up to preserve the tribe, poor souls."
Again Jack followed them as they went along, talking of the nature of the disease and of how badly it affected nations and communities that had never known it in the past, how mortal it was to Eskimos, for example, and how this particular infection must have been brought by a whaler, its visit proved by the axes. He felt a certain indignation against them, a resentment for his own unshared horror. And when Stephen turned to him as they joined the others and said, "I believe we may take coconuts here, and fruit and green stuff, robbing no man," he only answered with a sullen look and a formal inclination of his head. Stephen seized his mood and that of the waiting hands. The turning wind had told them all they'd not learned from their captain's face, bowed shoulders, heavy walk. And he went on, "May I suggest that you should take the nuts, particularly the very young milky nuts from the palms on the reef, while Mr. Martin and I look for our plants inland? Above all, do not stand about in this mephitic atmosphere. But first I beg that Mr. Reed may be taken back to the ship, and that the loblolly boy should be told to rub him all over with vinegar and cut off his hair before he goes aboard, where he must be kept in quarantine."
"Very well," said Jack. "I shall send the boat back for you whenever you wish."
"Not this boat, sir, if you'll allow me. This, too, must be scrubbed with vinegar by men who can show their pock marks. Another boat entirely, if you please. And it rowed only by hands that run no risk."
A path led inland from the village. Very rough, steep ground, strewn with boulders to begin with, covered with bushes and creepers. And under the bushes a few dead islanders, almost skeleton by now, with the limbs scattered. Then came a flat place, clear among the trees, its high, dry stone wall proof against the swine that could be heard rooting and grunting in the undergrowth no great way off. In this considerable enclosure grew yams, bananas of different kinds, various vegetables, standing together in no kind of order, but evidently planted there. The turned earth could still be seen beneath the springing weeds.
"That must be a colocasia," observed Martin, leaning on the wall.
"So it is. The taro itself, I believe."
"Yes, certainly, the taro. Its leaves, though bitter, improve when boiling, and it's a famous antiscorbutic."
They moved on, and always up, the bare rock of the path often polished by generations of feet. Three more enclosures, the last with a tall boar reared against the wall, trying to get in. By this time they were far beyond the pestilential smell, and Martin picked up a few mollusks, examining them closely before dropping them into a padded box, while Stephen pointed out an orchid fairly pouring out its cascade of white gold-tipped flowers from the crotch of a tree.
"I was prepared for the lack of land birds, mammals and reptiles, the more so as hogs have been turned out," said Martin, "but not for the wealth of plants. On the right hand of this path, from the last taro patch..."
"Did you hear that sound?" not unlike a woodpecker. They stood, their ears inclined. The path they were following rose steeply between palms and sandalwood to an abrupt rock face with a little platform before it, covered with a sweet-smelling terrestrial orchid. The sound, which had seemed to be coming from here, stopped. I've seen no less than 18 members of the Rubia Kai. Up and up in silence. Stephen, 2 paces ahead, with his eyes now on the level of the platform, slowly crouched down, and turning he whispered, "Ape. A small blue-black ape." The weak hammering started again and they crept on. Stephen very cautiously making room for Martin, who after a moment murmured, "Glabrous," in his ear. A second of the same kind appeared from behind a palm, and she, being upright and clear of the haze of orchids at eye level, could be seen to be a small, thin, black girl, also holding a nut. She joined the first, squatting and beating her nut on the broad, flat stone that obviously covered a well or spring. They looked very poorly, and Stephen straightened, coughing as he did so. The little girls clasped one another without a word, but didn't run. "Let us sit here looking away from them," said Stephen, taking little notice or none at all. "They're well over the disease, the first to take it, no doubt, but they're in a sad way." "How old would they be?"
"Who can tell? My practice has never lain among children, though I have, of course, dissected a good many. Say 5 or 6, poor, sad, ill-favoured little things. They cannot break their coconut."
And half-turned, he stretched out his hand and said, "Will I ever try?" Their minds were stunned not so much by terror or grief, but more by utter bewilderment and incomprehension. And to this was added extreme thirst. No rain these many days past. But there was still sense enough to understand the tone and gesture. And the first child handed her nut. Stephen pierced the soft eye with his lancet, and she drank with extraordinary application. Martin did the same for the second child. They could speak now, and they said the same word over and over again, pointing to the great stone and pulling them by the hand. With the slab removed, they plunged their faces right in and drank immoderately, their hollow bellies swelling like melons.
"As far as I can see," said Stephen, as he watched them eating the now broken coconut with dreadful avidity, "we must take them back to the ship, feed them and put them to bed. While the yams, taro and bananas are gathering, a party can search the island for other survivors. Clearly we can't leave them here to starve," said Martin. "But Lord Maturin, if only they'd been our nondescript apes, how we should have amazed London, Paris, Petersburg. Come, child."
Down the path, quite peaceably, hand in hand. But when they came to the highest enclosure, the little girls set up a roaring and had to be lifted over the wall. They ran straight to a familiar banana and ate all within their reach. The same happened at the second. But by the third, both were too tired and weak to go on, and Stephen and Martin reached the edge of the sea, carrying them fast asleep.
"We cannot hail the boat without waking them," observed Martin.
"Oh, what a quandary," said Stephen, whose child was infested with parasites. "Perhaps I can put it down." But at his first attempt, the black fingers clung to his shirt with such force that he stood up again, abandoning the notion altogether. There was no need to hail the boat, however. A far less keen-sighted man than Jack Aubrey could tell from half a mile that they were carrying not antiscorbutics, but some such creature as a sloth or a wombat. Yet even he looked a little blank when he saw them close and heard what was to be done. "Well, pass them over," he said. "Pollock, lay them on the sacks by the mast thwart."
"But that will wake them," said Martin. "Let me walk gently in by the gangplank."
"Nonsense," said Jack. "Anyone can see you're not a father, Mr. Martin." He took the child, passed it over, its head lolling, and Pollock eased it down under the sacks in a competent, husband-like manner. "When they're as sleepy as that, when they drool and hang loose,"
said Jack, in a more kindly tone. "You can tie them in knots without they wake or complain." This was eminently true. The children were handed up the side as limp as rag dolls, nor did they stir when they were put down on a paunch mat by the break of the forecastle. "Pass the word for Jemmy Ducks," said Jack Aubrey.
"Sir," said Jemmy Ducks, whose name was John Thurlow and whose office was the care of the ship's poultry, a term sometimes held to include rabbits and even larger animals.
"Jemmy Ducks, you're a family man, I believe."
At the captain's wholly unusual ingratiating tone and smile, Jemmy Ducks' eyes narrowed and his face took on a reserved, suspicious expression. But after some hesitation, he admitted that he had 7 or 8 of the little buggers over the Flicken, south by east of Shelmerston.
"Are any of them girls?"
3, sir. No, I tell a lie. 4.
"Then I dare say you're used to their ways."
"Well, you may say so, sir. Howling and screeching, teething and croup, thrust, red gum, measles and a bellyache, and poor old Thurlow walking up and down, rocking them in his arms all night and wondering dare he toss them out the window. Chamber pots, pap, boats, swaddling clothes, drying in the kitchen. That's why I signed on for a long, long voyage, sir."
"In that case, I'm sorry to inflict this task upon you. Look at the paunch in the shade of the starboard gangway. Those are 2 children brought back from the island. They're asleep. The party's going to look for any other survivors, but in the meantime they'll be washed all over with warm water and soap as soon as they wake up. And when they're dry, the loblolly boy will rub them over with an ointment the doctor's preparing."
"Lousy as well as poxed and filthy, sir?"
"Of course.
And I dare say you'll have their hair off, too. When that's done, you'll feed them in a seamanlike manner and stow them where the lambs were. You may ask Chips or the bosun for anything you need. Carry on, Jemmy Ducks."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"And if it lasts, you shall have a mate. Watch and watch."
"Thank you kindly, sir, just like by land.
Well, they say no man can escape his fate.
And if there are no survivors, you shall have 2 shillings a month hardship money."
There were no survivors. The Surprise sailed away in search of the southeast trades. But they were elusive far south of the line this year, and to reach them at all she had to contend both with the equatorial current and with faint, sometimes contrary, breezes, so that 0.5 degree of southing between noon and noon was something to celebrate. It was pleasant sailing, however, with blue skies, a darker sea, occasional squalls of warm rain that freshened the air, and the water cool enough to be refreshing when Jack bathed in the morning, diving from the mizzen chains. The ship was still well supplied with bosuns, carpenters and gunners' stores from her first lavish fitting out. The hint of scurvy had receded, Hayes' arm had knit Brampton's spirits had risen, and she was stocked with long-keeping fresh food. Long-keeping, which was just as well, since the weeks span out before they found the southeast trades, and even then the languid, capricious breezes scarcely deserved their name, still less their reputation for undeviating regularity. She sailed gently on, almost always on an even keel, and the weeks established a steady pattern of her people's life. In the morning they pumped the ship clear of the 18 inches of sea water that had been let in through the sweetening cock, a task in which Stephen and Martin shared, taking their places at the breaks from an obscure feeling that they were responsible for the standing order, a task that was at first looked upon with strong disapproval by the morning watch, but that was carried on out of habit without thought of complaint, even now that the Surprise was as sweet as the nutmeg. Then, in the forenoon, their few patients having been dealt with, they returned to the gun-room, and the long, even swell from the southeast being so easy and predictable, they didn't scruple to lay out even their most fragile specimens on the dining-table. That part of the afternoon watch which wasn't taken up with dining they usually spent in the mizzen-top, relating their experiences and observations in turn. Stephen had reached that part of his voyage in which he had walked up the side of an immense extinct volcano whose crater contained an isolated paradise in which the animals, protected by religion, Buddhist monks lived there,
piety, superstition, and plain remoteness, had never been hunted or killed or in any way molested, so that a man could walk about among them exciting no more than a mild curiosity. A country where he had pushed his way through grazing herds of deer and had sat with orangutans. Martin had no such glories to offer in the cold, bare Patagonian steppes to which his narrative had brought the surprise, but he did his best with the three-toed American ostrich, the long-tailed green parakeet, seen flying as far south as the entrance of the dreadful strait itself, flying, to the utter confusion of all accepted notions, over tight-packed bands of penguins lining that grim shore, the austral hummingbird, an eagle owl exactly like the one they'd seen in the Sinai Desert, and the flightless duck of Tierra del Fuego, whose nest he alone of all Western ornithologists had discovered under a tangle of snow-covered wintergreen not far from Port Famine. His matter was less, but his delivery was far better, he being used to public speaking. And as he was a tall, deep-chested man, his voice carried much farther than meagre Stevens. When he was speaking of these wonderful eggs, it carried right through the open skylight of the great cabin in which Jack Aubrey was writing home. As I said, we had intended to pass between the Solomons and the Queen Charlotte Islands, but we may have to put in at one group or the other in the hope of buying some hogs. Our progress has been so slow. He paused, and having chewed the end of his pen for a while, a quill from one of the smaller albatrosses, he went on, "I know you don't like it when I speak ill of any man, but I shall just say that there are moments when I wish Mr. Martin at the devil. It's not that he's not the most obliging, gentlemanly fellow, as you know very well, but he does take up so much of Stephen's time that I scarcely see anything of him. I should have liked to run through the score of this evening's piece with him, but they're nattering away the mizzen top 20 to the dozen, and I don't like to break in. To be sure, it is the usual fate of the captain of a man-of-war to live in solitary splendour, relieved only by some more or less obligatory and formal entertainment on one side or the other. But I've grown so used to the luxury of having a particular friend aboard these many commissions past that I feel quite bereft when it's taken from me." The ship's progress was slow, and although her bottom had been cleaned in Callao, in these warm seas it was growing dirty again in spite of her copper, so dirty that it cut half a knot from her speed in light airs. The little girl's progress in learning English, on the other hand, was extraordinarily rapid, and would have been even more so if some of the hands hadn't talked to them in the jargon used on the west coast of Africa. They were called Sarah and Emily, Stephen having set his face against Thursday and Behemoth. And since he had discovered them and brought them down to the shore, he was unquestionably their owner, with a right to name them. He usually spent some time with them every day. When they first came aboard, they were amazed and bewildered, and they clung to one another almost in silence in their dim and sheltered quarters. But presently, dressed in the simplest of Paul Davy shifts, they were to be seen running about on the forecastle, particularly during the afternoon watch, sometimes chanting in an odd, guttural way as they hopped from plank to plank, never touching the seams, sometimes imitating the songs the seamen sang. They were good little girls upon the whole, though rather stupid, and Emily could sometimes be both stubborn and passionate. They remained skinny however much they ate, and they had no claims to beauty. Jemmy Ducks had little difficulty in teaching them cleanliness. They were naturally given to washing when they were in health, and their lousiness arose from the nature of their hair, which was coarse and crinkled and stood straight out for 6 inches from their heads until the ship's barber clipped them bald, and from the fact that in those parts the comb had not yet been invented. And he hadn't much more in teaching them punctuality, for they quite soon grasped the meaning of the ship's bells.
They'd obviously acquired a sense of the holy long before they came aboard. And when Jemmy Ducks led them aft clean and brushed, they looked grave and fell silent as soon as they set foot on the quarter-deck. While at divisions, they stood at his side like images for the whole length of the ceremony. Once communication was established, they seemed uneasy if they were asked about their former existence. It was as though the whole of it had been a dream, and that they had now awoken from the dream to natural life, which consisted of sailing for ever, always southwest by south, to the unchanging rhythm of bells, wearing Poll Davy shifts washed twice a week, speaking a sort of English, drinking the thin, milkless porridge called skilligalee for breakfast. Cocoa is considered too rich for little girls. Eating lobscouse or sea pie and ship's biscuit, in which they delighted, for dinner, and more biscuit and broth for supper. So much was this the case, so much was this their life, that they were exceedingly distressed when, at length, a canoe full of Solomon Islanders came alongside. "Black boogers!" they cried in horror, and ran below. Although they never showed any signs of disliking the surprises negroes, indeed rather the reverse. And when they were brought on deck, Stephen holding Emily by the hand and Jemmy Duck Sarah, to see whether they could understand the chief of a village that visibly possessed hogs, they protested that they couldn't make out a word, would not, and sobbed so bitterly that they were obliged to be led away. "You may say they're stupid," said Martin at dinner in the cabin. "But have you observed that already they speak with a broad West Country burr on the forecastle and in quite another English on the quarter-deck?" "Certainly there is an uncommon linguistic ability," said Stephen. "And I have the strong impression that in their own island they used one language, or at least vocabulary, to their family, another to adults outside the family, and a third for sacred places or beings. Perhaps only variations of the same speech, but very strongly marked variations for sure." "It seems to me that they're forgetting their own language," said Jack. "You never hear them hallooing to one another in foreign as they used." "Could you ever forget your own language?" asked Pullings. "Languages you've learned, like Latin and Greek, yes, but your own? Though I speak under correction, sir, a post-captain knows more than a commander in the nature of things." Stephen drank wine. At one time he had very nearly forgotten his native Irish, the first language he ever spoke, he being fostered in the County Clare. And although it had surged up from the depths these last years when he spoke it with Padine, his almost monoglot servant, there were still words, and quite commonplace ones too, whose sounds were perfectly familiar, but whose meaning escaped him entirely. Padine Coleman, wholly illiterate, incapable of innocently giving away any information he might have picked up, for not only did he know very little English, but that little was barely comprehensible even to friends because of a defect in his speech, was a perfect servant for one so deeply engaged in political and naval intelligence as Stephen. Yet he was much more than that. A kind, gentle, deeply affectionate man, to whom Stephen was much attached, and whom he intended to find in New South Wales, in the penal settlement to which he'd been transported, and to do whatever could be done. He became aware of a silence round the table, and looking up he saw that they were all smiling at him. "I ask your pardon," he cried. "My mind was far away, gathering wool, merino wool. Forgive me, I beg. Did anyone ask me a question?" "Not at all," said Jack, filling his glass. "I was just telling Tom that now the time has come to reduce sail, and when the deck is less like the side of a house, you and Mr. Martin might like to take off your fine coats and carry your glasses up. These reefs, rocks and islands often have birds for 50 miles around them. Norfolk Island had some prodigious curious birds that made burrows, flying home at night." It wasn't until a little before the surprise crossed the Tropic of Capricorn that the trade wind had really started to blow. But since then, close-hauled or with the wind 1 point free, she'd been showing what she could really do, with t'gallants over reef topsails and a glorious series of jibs and staysails, white and sometimes green water sweeping over her weather bow, the little girl soaked through and through and shrieking with delight, her lively deck at an angle that made it impossible to fix a bird in one's glass unless one were lashed to a solid support, when one might well have one's valuable achromatic telescope of more than extra power smothered in foam. She reeled off at 12 and even 13 knots throughout the sunlit hours and 7 or 8 by night, with the t'gallantsails taken in and in spite of her foul bottom. And all this through a hugely rolling sea that varied from the deepest indigo to pale aquamarine, but that always, apart from the broken water, remained glass clear as though it had been created yesterday. Her pace slackened only at sunrise and sunset, when Jack and Mr. Adams, who dearly loved statistics, took their readings of the temperature at various depths, the salinity, and the atmospheric pressure. But these were also days during which high white clouds passed in flocks across the sky, while others, higher still by far, moved in the opposite direction on the anti-trade. An interesting phenomenon, and one rarely seen to such perfection. Yet it had the disadvantage of shutting out the stars, and even, for fine observation, the sun. And as Jack didn't choose to rely on dead reckoning, above all in these waters, he decided to proceed at a moderate pace that afternoon, so that his lookouts might catch sight of one of the notorious reefs in these latitudes, the Angerit Shoal, which with rollers of this kind showed as a white boil even at spring tides and was used by many commanders as a sea mark. Jack called for coffee. It came in an elegant silver pot protected by white manila fenders, beautifully plaited by Bondon in the form of robands. And as they drank it, the sail came off the ship, the rushing sound of the water along her side diminished, and they no longer sat braced in their chairs. "When you come on deck," said Jack, "don't scruple to walk the windward side. That's where my reef should be, if it has any sense of what's right." And he pushed civility so far as to ask Mr. Martin to sup in the cabin that evening and play music. Although his execution was indifferent, his sense of pitch and time imperfect, and he always played rather sharp. They stood by the windward rail of the quarter-deck, discreetly aft. And a fine waste of blue water did they command, an unending series of wide-spaced, rounded crests, sometimes topped with white, all crossed with a transverse ripple from the local current. They leant there in their shirt-sleeves, spattered by spindrift on occasion, but comfortable in the sun, warm, though veiled. "You met Macmillan, my assistant in the Nutmeg, I believe," said Stephen. "Just for a moment. A tall, thin young Scotchman, very concerned at being left in charge. An amiable youth, diligent, conscientious, but necessarily inexperienced. I remember telling him of the miseries of human life, particularly as they affect medical men. I spoke of that continual, insistent demand for sympathy and personal concern that exhausts all but the most saintly man's supply before the end of the day, leaving him openly hard in a hospital or a poor practice, secretly hard in a rich one, and ashamed of his hardness in either case, until he comes to what terms he can with the situation. But I omitted another aspect, trifling in itself, yet one that can become disproportionately irritating. There's a good example." Glancing forward to where Awkward Davis was packing a mended shirt into his bag. The massive, lowering creature was sometimes possessed by an elfin gaiety. And now he seized Emily, hoisted her onto the back of his neck, bade her clap on tight now, and raced up the foremast shrouds, over the top rim and right up to the crosstrees, the child hooting with joy all the way. That great, hulking fellow, for whom I may say I have a real liking, is, as you know, very well growing madder. And I give him a weekly draught of hellebore to prevent him doing any of his shipmates an injury. He's irascible and exceedingly strong. And every single time he presents himself for his dose with a poor face, a mincing, shuffling gait, a pursed mouth, his great head inclined to one side, and answers my questions in a weak, gasping tone like an old ewe, I should kick him if I dared. Shoal ho! From the masthead. The usual question, the bearing as usual, the usual hurrying up and down. And in time the unmistakable turmoil of white water could be seen from the deck broad on the larboard beam. "It's very well," said Martin when he'd looked at it for some time through his telescope. "And I should be ungrateful to repine, but I could wish that Captain Aubrey had given us as clear a view of the Great Barrier Reef." I had hoped above all for that Lizard Island from which Cook and Sir Joseph surveyed the passages. Yet I can well understand the captain's reluctance. The Endeavour at last got outside the reef by means of these passages, but then the breeze failed them, as it will, close to the land, and the huge swell heaved them in slowly, inevitably, and they, helpless, towards the great wall of coral and the mountainous surf. At the very last moment, a hint of breeze moved them just far enough for the making tide to sweep them through a channel to the inner side of the reef. I remember Sir Joseph telling us of it, and the horror of those last heaves before apparent destruction were with him still. It was much the same with us in the Diane off Tristan, as I've told you. I was below at the time, but she was within 10 yards of the cliff, the precipitous cliff of the island inaccessible, before just such a providential waft of air edged her aside. And the captain is absolutely determined not to call upon Providence in that way again. He has nothing whatsoever to say to any reef, coral or otherwise. Martin digested this for some time, and then said in a low voice, "The little girls have quite a family of pet rats now." "Indeed? I knew they had one apiece, but not several." "Half a dozen at least," said Martin. "Do you think that might be a Norfolk Island petrel?" "It might be, too. There's a group of them somewhat to the east." "No, my dear Martin, the east is to the right." "Surely not in the southern hemisphere." "We'll ask Captain Aubrey, he'll probably know, but to the right for our love." "Ah, they're vanished and gone." They returned to the rats. How mild in temper they were, and placid, and how they were to be seen wandering about in the day, well above the hold and even the cable tier. The hands put it down to the unnatural cleanliness of the ballast, flooded every night and pumped clear every day. It was known that rats fattened on the smell. And now, with the barkie tossed about so that her ballast was fairly scoured, as clean as Deal Beach, there was no smell. "Sail ho!" cried the masthead. And this time, in answer to Jack's "Where away?", the lookout answered, "Right ahead, sir. As right ahead as ever could be. Square rigged, but ship or brig I cannot tell." The Surprise had been making sail methodically ever since she'd obtained her fix with the Anchorage Shoal, and now she was making a good 10 knots. The sail ahead was travelling faster, and presently Oakes at the jack called down that she was certainly a ship, weather stunsails aloft and alow. Then later, "Man o' war pennant, sir." And later still, when she was hull up on the rise, "Two decker, sir." "Aha!" said Jack to Pullings. "She must be the old Trump, 54. Billy Holroyd has her now. Did you ever meet Captain Holroyd, Tom?" "I don't think so, sir. I know him by name, of course. We were shipmates in the Sylph when we were boys." Then louder, "Pass the word for Killick." "Sure," cried Killick, appearing like a jack-in-the-box. "Turn over my pantry and see what we can manage in the way of a feast."
"She's thrown out the private signal, sir," said Reed to Mr. Davidge, the officer of the watch. Davidge repeated the news to Pullings, now serving as first lieutenant again, and Pullings told Jack, who ordered the usual reply to be followed immediately by "Heave to and come to supper," while at the same time the Surprise bore up to make the signal more perfectly legible, and Jack called "Stand by to reduce sail and heave to." The Trump's response couldn't be made out for some moments, she being head-on with the wind 2 points on the quarter, but then Reed, who had grown wonderfully adroit at managing a telescope with the far end on some support in the rigging, reported, "It is charged with dispatches, sir."
"He cannot stop," said Stephen to Martin. "I doubt he would be allowed to pause even if we were beset by ravening sharks rather than by ravening curiosity."
Nor did he stop. But he modified the strict rule by easing his sheets as his ship, a slab-sided Dutch-built vessel on her way to India by Torres Strait, swept past the stationary, wallowing Surprise within 20 yards, both captains standing on the hammock netting.
"How do you do, Billy?"
called Jack, waving his hat.
"Jack, how do you do?" replied Billy.
"What news?"
"In India, they say Boney has done it again, somewhere in Germany. Silesia, I think. 220 guns taken the Prussian right wing cut to pieces."
"What news from home?"
"None when I left Sydney Cove. Amelia 4 months overdue and no..."
The rest of his words were lost, the strong wind sweeping them along with the ship. All the Surprise's people had been listening openly without shame. All faces showed the same disappointment. And when Jack gave the order, "Brace up and haul aft," they carried it out with less than their usual zest and spring.
"I'm so sorry you'll not see Captain Holroyd this bout," said Jack as they gathered for supper. "You'd like him, I'm sure. He has a very pure, sweet voice, a true tenor, which is a rare thing in a service that requires you to roar like a bull in a basin. But still, I hope we shall profit from Killick's thorough search of the pantry. There may be some Java delicacies that Mrs. Raffles was so kind as to put up for us."
By this time the watch had been set, t'gallants taken in long since, and topsails double-reefed. And when 3 bells in the first watch struck, they could be heard in the great cabin, remote but clear, the last note hanging up, unpaired. Automatically Jack glanced at the dining cabin door, which ordinarily opened as regularly as that of a cuckoo clock, with Killick in the place of the bird, saying, "Suppers on table, sir, if you please," or "Whittles is up," according to the company. It did not open, though there appeared to be a scrabbling behind it, and Jack poured more Madeira. "But now I come to think of it, Mr. Martin," he said, "I believe you prefer sherry as a whet. Pray forgive me." He reached for the other decanter.
"Not at all, sir, not at all," cried Martin. "I'd far rather drink Madeira. I shouldn't change this Madeira for any kind of sherry. It's dry but full of body. It's given me the appetite of a lion."
Stephen walked over to his cello, and sitting on the stern window locker, he played over the Rakes of Kerry in Pizzicato.
"You should hear that at some far grassy crossroads on a fine Beltane night, with the fire on the hill and the pipes playing and 5 fiddles and the young men dancing as though they were possessed and the young women as demure as mice but never missing a step."
"Pray play it again," said Jack. He did. Then again with variations and even some thoughts of his own. At length the door opened, and Killick stood there in the opening, pale and apparently demented.
"Is supper ready?" asked Jack.
"Well, the soup part of it is, sir," said Killick hesitantly. "Sort of.
But, sir," he burst out, "the rats has ate the smoked tongues, ate the preserves, ate the potted char, ate the last of the Java pickles, and they're walking about there paying no heed, staring, saucy. I turned everything over, sir, everything. It took me hours."
"Well, at least they can't have got at the wine," Put that on the table, serve the soup and tell my cook to do what he can. Bear a hand, there.
A balmy side feast, I'm afraid, said Jack.
Not at all, sir, said Martin. There's nothing I prefer to...
He hesitated, trying to find a name for salt beef 18 months in the cask, partly desalted, cut up very small, and fried with crushed ships, biscuits and a great deal of pepper, to a fricassee.
Still, said Jack, I'm sure the doctor's divertimento in C major will...
He almost said divert our minds, but in fact ended with prove a compensation.
It was some days later, after a violent blow that was said, and rightly said, to foretell a calm, when they were no more than a couple of 100 miles from Sydney, that Stephen, finding his bedside box of coca leaves empty, went down to the storeroom he shared with Jack to bring up a new supply. The leaves were packed tight in soft leather sausages, sewn over with a neat surgical stitch, each in a double-oiled skin envelope against the damp. He'd almost exactly calculated the duration of each, and apart from the current, already opened pouch, there were easily enough of the comfortable little parcels to last till he should reach Callao, for it was from Peru that the coca leaves came. The pouches were in a particularly massive and elegant ironwood chest with intricate Javanese brasswork over its top and sides. And although he had heard and seen much of the strange, confident behaviour of the rats, he had no fear of them in this particular instance. Apart from anything else, this storeroom was used for wine, cold-weather clothes, books. It had nothing to do with the pantry. Yet he was not the first sailor to be deceived by a rat. They had gnawed their way up through the very plank, up through the bottom of the chest itself. There was nothing left but rat dung. Nothing. They'd eaten all the leaves, and all the leather impregnated with the scent of the leaves, and they were clearly eager to get at the chest again, a group of them standing just outside the lit circle of his lantern, waiting impatiently to gnaw at the wood on which the pouches had lain.
"I must take care of our herbs and the portable soup," he reflected, and he walked into the sick berth where Martin was taking stock of the medicine chest in the hope of replenishing it at Sydney. "Listen, colleague," he said, "those infernal rats have eaten my coca leaves. Those leaves you recall that I chew from time to time. I remember them well. You gave me some off the horn when we were so very cold and hungry. But I'm afraid I disappointed you by complaining that the ensuing numbness or insensibility of my palate, indeed of my whole mouth, made what little food we had miserably insipid and that I felt no good effect at all. Sure, it differs according to idiosyncrasy. For me, and I think most Peruvians, it induces a mild euphory, an absence of untimely sleepiness and hunger, a tranquillity of mind and, perhaps, enhanced powers of reflection. And it's plain that rats feel this even more strongly. I remember now when last I was at that chest, filling my bedside box from an open pouch perhaps a fortnight ago, I spilt some on the floor. And in the insolence of my wealth, I didn't gather it all up, but left the smaller pieces in the dust. This they must have found and eaten. And they were so pleased with the result that they tried by all means to get at the rest, eventually gnawing a hole through the bottom. So I think we should put all our herbs and the like into metal-lined boxes. The animals, having derived such satisfaction from the coca and having finished it to the last leaf, are now no doubt eagerly, fearlessly searching for more. That would account for the devastation in the captain's pantry, never attacked before. It would also account for this whole change in behaviour that we've observed. Their mildness, their confident wandering about the ship and contemplating the passers-by. This when they'd had their leaves. And their eagerness to get more. They stood about me as I gazed at the ruins of my store, my only indulgence, Martin, gibbering, barely able to contain themselves. I'm afraid it must be a sad vexation to have had your whole supply destroyed, said Martin, but I hope it's not as serious as the loss of tobacco to a smoker. Oh, no. It doesn't cause a vehement addiction as tobacco sometimes does. Though, curiously enough, some of its effects are not unlike. And it quite does away with the need to smoke. I still enjoy my occasional cigar after a good dinner. But if I have had my little bowl of lime-sprinkled leaves in the morning, I'm perfectly content without it. The next day, both Emily and Sarah were bitten by their tame rats. They wept. And they wept still more when Stephen cauterized the wounds. In the afternoon, the rats disappeared from those parts of the ship where they'd caused most astonishment, but they could be heard fighting on the cable tier and in the hold. Yet there were few people to hear the furious scuffling fore and aft, the death shriek and the screams of rage, for in this flat calm, turtles, green turtles, had been seen basking on the surface. And the Surprise's boats, lowered down with the greatest caution and paddled rather than pulled, caught four. All female and all quite stout, none less than 100 weight. There was also the killing of the last Solomon pig. As Jack Aubrey insisted upon giving Martin an edible dinner to wipe out the disgrace of supper. A high ceremony for all those brought up with pigs about the house, which was the case with most of the Surprises, and one followed by black puddings and many another delight. On the evening after this first dinner, Stephen retired to his alternative lower cabin, where he could write in unobserved solitude, thrust balls of wax into his ears so that he could do so in something like silence, trimmed his green shaded lamp, poised his cigar on a pewter dish and wrote, "It is whimsical enough, my dearest soul, to think that on this, almost the last day of our voyage, all hands should have eaten like aldermen. Yet such is the case, and such will be the case tomorrow, when the gunroom invites Jack and the two midshipmen to what will probably be the last dinner before we enter Sydney Cove. For the wind has revived, and through my wax I hear the measured impact of the swell against the frigate's bow. Fresh pork and green turtle. They are good in themselves, and after our very short commons they were, of course, better by far. I ate voraciously, and now I'm smoking like a voluptuous Turk. Which brings me to the curious incident of the other day. I went below to fill the empty bedside box of coca leaves and found that rats had eaten all my store. It had all gone, even to the oiled silk outer cases. For some time the behaviour of the ship's rats, a numerous crew, had excited comment, and it is now clear to me that they had become slaves to the coca. Now that they've eaten it all, now that they are deprived of it, all their mildness, lack of fear, and what might even be called their complacence is gone. They are rats and worse than rats. They fight, they kill one another, and were I to unblock my ears, I should hear their harsh, strident screams. So far I have killed no one, nor have I desired to do so, but in other ways I too feel my lack. I eat exorbitantly, my eyes starting from my head, whereas coca imposes moderation. I smoke and relish it extremely, whereas coca does away with tobacco. Sleep is near to closing my stupid eyes, whereas coca keeps one contentedly awake until the middle watch. I hope we shall see Sydney the day after tomorrow. Primo, secundo, tertio, and so to infinity, because in spite of the dismal words, no news from home, I may hear from you by some earlier ship. And then, not to be mentioned on the same page, because some apothecary or medical man may renew my stock as it was renewed in Stockholm. I should be sorry to be reduced to the state of the two animals I see but do not hear in the corner by my stool. Do not hear, so that their frenzied, tight-locked battle has a horror of its own.
Yet man, or at all events this particular man, is so weak that if an innocent leaf can protect him even a little, then hey for the innocent leaf. The gunroom's feast for the captain was, if anything, more copious than that of the day before. It was less gorgeous, seeing that in the surprise's present unlisted state as H.M.'s hired vessel, the gunroom didn't rise above pewter, except for its forks and spoons. But the gunroom cook, by means known to himself alone, had conserved the makings of a superb suet pudding of the kind called boiled baby in the service, known to be Jack Aubrey's favourite form of food, and it came in on a scrubbed scuttle cover to the sound of cheering. Another difference between the old HMS Surprise and HM Hired Vessel Surprise was that there were no lines of servants, one behind each officer's chair. For one thing, she carried no marines or boys, the main source of supply, and for another, it would have been quite out of tune with her present ship's company's state of mind. There was not so much glory. The sequence of dishes was slower. But the conversation was far less restrained. And when even Killick and the gunroom steward retired, Jack, a fine purple with satiety, gazed round the table, smiling at his host, and said, "I don't know whether any of you gentlemen have touched at Sydney before." No, they said they hadn't. "The doctor and I were there some years ago when I had the leopard. It was at that uneasy time when the soldiers and Governor Bligh had been at cross purposes, so we did no more than take in what trifling stores the military men would let us have and sailed on. But I was ashore long enough to get a general impression, and a very nasty general impression it was. The place was run by soldiers. And although some time later those who had deposed the governor were put to stand in the corner for a while, I hear that things are much the same. So I'll tell you what I found and what I dare say you'll still find when you go ashore. I say nothing about Admiral Bligh and his disagreements with the army, but I will say that quite apart from those quarrels, I never met a soldier that didn't dislike a sailor. I found them an overdressed, underbred, inhospitable, quarrelsome set of men. I know the army's not very particular about the people who buy a commission in new-raised, out-of-the-way regiments, but even so I was astonished. They'd pretty well monopolised trade, forming a ring that did away with all competition. They'd taken up all the good land which they farmed with free convict labour. They were exploiting the place for all they were worth. Infinitely worse than all that, worse than their corrupt selling to government at starvation prices, was their treatment of the wretched prisoners. I've been aboard more than one hell afloat, and they make a man's heart sick, but I have never seen anything to touch the cruelty in New South Wales. Floggings of 500 lashes, 500 lashes, were commonplace. And even in the short time I was there, two men were whipped to death. I tell you this because these fellows know damn well that people fresh to the place are shocked and look upon them as blackguards. They're very touchy about it, very apt to take offence. And you may easily find yourself called out for a trifling observation. So it seems to me that distant civility is the thing. Official invitations, no more. There's no one here who could possibly be accused of want of conduct. But a quarrel with a blackguard is like a court case with a pauper. The whole thing is a toss-up. There's no justice in either. And while you have nothing to win, he has nothing to lose." "Did you say a court case, sir?" asked West. "Yes, I did," said Jack. "What I really meant was that a blackguard can point a pistol as well as a decent man, and that it's much better to avoid the possibility of such an encounter. There was a jumped-up fellow here called MacArthur, who put a bullet in Patterson's shoulder, though Patterson was all an officer should be, and the other was a scoundrel." "I met MacArthur in London," said Stephen. "He was there for his court-martial, acquitted, of course. and Southdown Kemsley, with whom he'd been in correspondence on sheep, brought him to dinner at the Royal Society Club. Loud, positive and overbearing, at first extremely formal, then extremely familiar, full of lewd anecdotes. He wanted to buy some of the King's merinos, and he proposed calling on Sir Joseph Banks, who supervised the flock. But Sir Joseph, who was in close touch with the colony, had had such reports of his undesirability that he declined receiving him. His regiment was universally known as the Rum Corps, because rum was its first basis of trade, wealth, power, influence and corruption. I believe that there are changes now that Governor Macquarie has come out with the 73rd Regiment, but the old Rum Corps officers are still here, in the administration, or sitting on great stretches of good land granted to themselves by themselves, and more or less running the country, alas. The dinner didn't end on this solemn note. Indeed, it ended in very cheerful song. But the next day's breakfast was a gloomy affair, although the coast of New South Wales was clear all along the western horizon and the pilot was already aboard. There was a most unaccustomed silence on either side of the coffee pot, and Jack, for one, looked yellow, puffy, liverish. He hadn't taken his morning swim, and his eyes, usually bright blue, were now dull, oyster-like, with discoloured bags below them. His breath was foul. "The doctor wasn't drunk too, was he?" asked Bondon in the cuddy where Killick was grinding beans for a second pot. "Drunk, no," said Killick. "I wish he had been. It would make his crabbedness more natural. I don't know what's come over him, such a mild-spoken cove. He slapped Sarah and Emily till they howled again. And he checked Joe Place something cruel, walking backwards into him on the forecastle. Can't you see where you're a-coming to? God damn your eyes and limbs, you fat-arsed bugger of a longshoreman." Or words to that effect. "I tell you what it is, Stephen," said Jack, after a prolonged silence. "I don't think the gunroom's turtle was quite wholesome." "Nonsense," said Stephen. "Never was such a healthy, clean-run reptile. The trouble is, you ate too much as you did the day before, and as you do habitually whenever it's there to eat. I've told you again and again that you're digging your grave with your teeth. You are at present suffering from a plethory, a common plethory. I can deal with the symptoms of this plethory, but the self-indulgence that lies behind them is beyond my reach." "Pray do deal with them, Stephen," said Jack. "We shall drop anchor this afternoon, unless the breeze fails us. The governor's sure to ask us to dinner tomorrow, and I couldn't face a laid table as I feel now. You'll have to take physic, of course, and it'll confine you to the seat of ease for most of the day, and perhaps part of the night. You obese subjects are often slow working where the colon is concerned." "I shall take whatever you order," said Jack. "To clean and refit a ship properly and without loss of time, you have to be tolerably well with the authorities. And to be tolerably well with the authorities, you have to eat their food hearty and drink up their wine as though you enjoyed it. At present, the thought of anything but a bare biscuit holding up a piece and thin black coffee makes my gorge rise." "I shall fetch what is required," said Stephen, returning some minutes later with a pillbox, a bottle and a measuring glass. "Swallow this," he said, passing a pill, "and wash it down with that," passing the half-filled glass. "Are you sure it's enough?" asked Jack. "I'm not one of your lightweights, you know, not one of your Borrell shrimps, and it's a very small pill." "Rest easy while you may," said Stephen. "You may be the biggest Borden of earth, but black draught and blue pill will search your entrails and stir your torpid liver. It'll sort you out finely, so it will." He put the cork back into the bottle with a thump and walked off, reflecting upon exasperation, an emotion aroused by some persons in some situations in an eminent degree. Having edged three dead rats out of the sick berth, he did some work on his records. Then he rolled a little paper cigar and climbed to the quarterdeck to smoke it.
There had been some candid remarks about tobacco below, and he was obliged to admit that the cold, stale smell of several dead cigars that seeped from his lower cabin into the gunroom did make it more like a low pothouse at dawn than was altogether agreeable. Martin had already been on deck for some time, watching the magnificent harbour opening before them. "Here's Sydney Cove at last," he said, with a somewhat irritating enthusiasm. "It grieves me to contradict you," said Stephen, "but this is Port Jackson. Sydney Cove is only a little small bay about 5 miles down on the left."
"Good heavens, do you mean to tell me they're the same? I had no idea.
Shall have not mentioned it above 100 times.
"So this is the home of the Port Jackson shark," cried Martin, looking eagerly over the side.
"Aha," said Stephen, to whom the thought had occurred many and many a time before, but not today.
"Let us see if we can fish one up."
He picked his way through a party of men on their knees, improving the look of the quarterdeck seams, and reached for the mizzen topsail halyards to which the shark hooks and their chains were made fast. But before he could seize them, Tom Pullings was there.
"No, sir," he said very firmly, "not today, if you please. There can be no shark fishing today. We've been preddying the decks ever since 2 bells in the morning watch. Surely, sir, you wouldn't want surprise to look paltry in Sydney Cove."
Stephen might have advanced that it was only a small, inoffensive shark, not above 4 feet long, that it had a unique arrangement of flat, grinding teeth of the first interest, and that the inconvenience would be trifling. But Tom Pulling's immovable gravity, the immovable gravity of all the surprises on deck, who had stopped work to look at him, and even of the pilot, a man-of-war's man himself, checked the words in his throat.
"We'll fish up a couple for you day after tomorrow," said Pullings.
"Half a dozen," cried the boatswain.
"Oh, if you please, sir," cried Jemmy Ducks, coming after the run. "Sarah swallowed a pin."
The medical men had more trouble, spent more time with this one pin than with the results of many a brisk action, with splinter wounds, fractures, and even the minor amputations. And when at last it was recovered and the exhausted, emptied child had been put to bed, they found they'd missed the entire approach to Sydney. The shores and the stratified cliffs of Port Jackson and the various branches of the harbour of which Martin had heard great things. They'd also missed the boarding of the ship by an officer from the shore and their dinner itself. But they cared little for either. And Stephen, observing that Captain Aubrey would certainly be indisposed by now, remained below eating scraps with Martin. He then found himself overcome with sleep in spite of the gunroom steward's idea of coffee, and retired to his cabin. It was in this same cabin that he sat next day in white breeches, silk stockings, gleaming buckled shoes, a newly shaved face, and a newly clipped poll. His best uniform coat and his newly curled, newly powdered wig hung close at hand, not to be touched until the barge was lowered down. To try his pen, a new-cut quill, he wrote "exasperation" 6 times, and then returned to his letter. No news, of course. Jack sent as soon as we were moored, but there was no news from home. Official papers by way of India, yes, but all that matters is still between here and the Cape, somewhere in the Southern Ocean. I comfort myself by reflecting that it may come while we are still here. And I need comfort. I've told you many times, I'm sure, that the common seaman believes that more is better and has to be watched to prevent him swallowing whole vials of physic. In this, Jack is as common as any of them, and more dangerous to himself in that he has the habit of command. Late yesterday he formed the opinion that my black draught and blue pill were not working briskly enough, and while I was asleep he practised upon Martin, and by means that do him no credit he obtained a second dose. Now, of course, he can't stir from the quarter gallery. He's quite incapable of accepting the invitation to Government House this afternoon.
and Tom Pullings and I are to go without him. It is not a dinner I look forward to with any pleasure. This morning I was ashore looking in vain for an apothecary, merchant or medical man who might have the leaves of coca, and I found the miserable place much as I left it. Squalid, dirty, formless, with ramshackle wooden huts placed without regard to anything but temporary convenience 20 years ago. Dust, apathetic, ragged convicts, all filthy, some in chains. The sound of chains everywhere. And turning into an unpaved, uneven kind of a square, I came full upon those vile triangles, and a flogging in progress, the man hanging from the apex. Flogging I have seen only too often in the Navy, but rarely more than a dozen lashes, and those laid on with a relative decency. A bystander told me that this man had already received 185 out of his 200. Yet still the burly executioner stepped well back and made a double skip each time to bring his whip down with the greater force, taking off flesh at every blow. The ground was soaked with fresh blood, and there was a red darkness at the foot of the other triangles. To my astonishment, the man was able to stand when he was untied. His face showed not so much suffering as utter despair. His friends led him away, and as he went, the blood welled from his shoes at every step. A little farther on, I came to some more of these gaunt barracks, and to a street being laid out by a chain gang, and the beginning of what the men told me was to be a hospital built at the orders of the new governor, Colonel Macquarie. I shall be sorry not to see him, but he is away in... "Boats along, Sergeant, if you please," said Killick, that forgiving soul, as he took up the precious coat. "Right arm first. Now let me ship the wig and square it just so. Hold up, and don't you ever move your head, or you get powder on the collar. And here," with a transparently false casualness, "is your gold-headed cane." "You're sold to the devil, Killick," said Stephen. "Do you think I'm going to walk into a company of officers with a cane, like a grass-combing civilian?" "Then let me borrow the captain's patriotic fund sword," said Killick. "You're in such a shabby old hilt." "Buckle it on and bear away," said Stephen. "How has the captain come along since I came below?" "Which has taken a 90-year lease of the quarter gallery. All you can hear is groaning and gushing. He ain't been out since you was there." Stephen was carefully handed down the side and sat in the stern sheets. He was followed by Pullings, shining with gold lace but smelling of mould, and the boat shoved off. "Another dinner table," reflected Stephen, sitting down and spreading his napkin over his knee. "May it be for a blessing." The afternoon had begun pleasantly, with Mrs. Macquarie and the Governor's deputy, Colonel Macpherson, receiving the guests, mostly officers of the former New South Wales Corps, now substantial landowners, of the 73rd and of the Navy. Mrs. Macquarie, the most important woman in the colony, didn't topple the gracious lady, but made them feel truly welcome. Stephen liked her at once, and they talked for a while. Colonel Macpherson had served for many years in India, and it was clear that his head had been too long exposed to the sun. But he was amiable enough in his muffled way, and he took pleasure in urging the men to drink. The men, for Mrs. Macquarie was not to attend the dinner itself, and no other ladies had been invited. "I'm so sorry that Her Excellency has abandoned us," he said to Mr. Hamlin, a surgeon who sat on his left. "She seemed to me particularly sympathetic, and I should have liked to ask her advice. We picked up 2 children, the only survivors of a small tribe wiped out by smallpox, and I dread taking them by the icy horn to a hardly more hospitable England than they born under the equator itself." "She would certainly have told you what to do," said Hamlin. "She's spending this very afternoon in the orphanage. We've a great many little bastards here, you know, begotten by the Lord knows who during the voyage, and often abandoned. And as you say, she's the most amiable of ladies. We passed the chief of the morning discussing plans for the hospital. Stephen and the surgeon did the same until it was time for each to talk to his other neighbour. Hamlin was at once engaged in a close and even passionate argument about some horses that were to race presently. But on Stephen's right, the penal secretary, whom he thought of as Mealy Mouth, but whose name was in fact Firkins, was already taken up with a four- or five-handed conversation about convicts, the irredeemable wickedness, sloth, immorality of convicts, the assignment of convicts, their dangerous nature. And for some time he was able to survey the table. Mealy Mouth, he observed, was a water drinker. But Stephen, having taken a sip of the local wine, could hardly blame him for that. Immediately opposite was a big, dark-faced man, as big as Jack Aubrey or even bigger. He wore regimentals that Stephen didn't recognise, presumably those of the Rum Corps. His very large face had a look of stupidity and settled ill temper. He wore a surprising number of rings. To this man's right sat the clergyman who had said grace, and he too looked thoroughly discontented. His face was unusually round. It was red, and growing steadily redder. From the confusion of voices and the unfamiliarity of their topics, it wasn't easy for Stephen to make out more than the general drift at first, but that was clear enough from the often repeated United Irishmen and defenders. Prisoners who had been transported in large numbers, particularly after the 1798 rising in Ireland. He noticed that the Scottish officers of the 73rd didn't take part. But they were in the minority, and the general feeling was well summed up by the clergyman who said, "The Irish do not deserve the appellation of men. And if I needed an authority for the statement, I should bring forward Governor Collins of Van Diemen's Land." Those are his very words, in the second volume of his book, I believe. But no authority is needed for what is evident to the meanest understanding. And now to crown all priests are allowed them. A cunning priest can make them do anything, and there's nothing but anarchy to be foreseen. "Who is that gentleman?" asked Stephen in a low voice, Hamlin having finished with horse racing for the moment. "His name is Marsden," said Hamlin, "a wealthy sheep farmer and a magistrate at Parramatta. And once he's on to the poor old Pope and Popery, he never leaves off." "How true." Stephen saw Tom Pulling's bored face fixed in a dutiful smile near the head of the table on Colonel Macpherson's right, and at the same time Tom looked at him. A very anxious look. "I beg your pardon," said the penal secretary. "I'm shamefully remiss. Allow me to help you to a little of this dish. It's kangaroo, our local venison." "You're very good, sir," said Stephen, looking at it with some interest. "Can you tell me..." But Firkins was already away on a hobby horse of his own, the poverty of Ireland and its inevitability. His words were mostly addressed to the other side of the table, though when he'd finished his account, he turned to Stephen and said, "They're not unlike our Aborigines. They're the most feckless people in the world. If you give them sheep, they'll not wait for them to breed and grow into a flock. They eat them at once. Poverty, dirt and ignorance must necessarily attend them." "Did you ever read in Bede, sir?" asked Stephen. "Bede? I don't think I know the name. Was he a legal writer?" "I believe he's chiefly known for his ecclesiastical history of the English nation." "Ah, then Mr. Marsden will know him. Mr. Marsden," raising his voice, "do you know of a Mr. Bede that wrote an ecclesiastical history?" "Bede? Bede?" said Marsden, breaking off his conversation with his neighbour. "Never heard of him." Then, resuming it, "He was a mere boy, so we only gave him 100 lashes on the back and the rest on his bottom and legs." "Bede lived in the County Durham," said Stephen in a momentary pause. Little do I or other naturalists know of the northern parts of England, but it is to be hoped that some future faunist, a person of a thinking turn of mind, a man of fortune, will undertake the tour, accompanied by a botanist and a draughtsman, and will give us an account of his journey. The manners of the wild aborigines, their superstitions, their prejudices, their sordid way of life, will extort from him many useful reflections. And his draughtsmen will portray the ruins of the great monasteries of Wearmouth and Jarrow, the home of the most learned man in England 1,000 years ago, famous throughout the Christian world, and now forgotten. Such a work would be well received. Perhaps. The remark, however, was received in disapproving silence, with puzzled, suspicious looks. And eventually the big man opposite Stephen said, "There ain't any aborigines in Durham." While the learned explained to him what might be meant by the word, Stephen said inwardly, "Let me not be a fool. God preserve me from choler." And a flow of talk from the upper end of the table swept the incident into the past. "I'm so sorry," he said, suddenly aware that Hamlin was speaking to him. "I was wool-gathering again. I was contemplating on sheep." "And I was talking to you about sheep. How droll," said Hamlin. "I was telling you that your vis-à-vis Captain Lowe has imported some of the Saxony merinos to make a new cross." "Has he a great many sheep?" "Probably more than anyone else. It's said he's the richest man in the colony." The flogging parson, redder still, had begun savaging the Pope again. And to shut him out, Stephen replied in a louder voice, "Curiously enough, it was merinos that I was thinking of, the king's merinos. They are of the Spanish breed, however." "Are you talking about merinos?" asked Captain Lowe. "Yes," said Hamlin. "Dr. Maturin here has seen the king's flock." "Sir Joseph Banks was good enough to show them to me," said Stephen. Lowe looked at him with contempt, and after some thought replied, "I don't give a button for Sir Joseph Banks." "I'm sure he would be grieved to hear it. Why did he try to prevent Captain MacArthur getting any of the king's sheep? Because MacArthur was from the colony, I suppose." "Surely not. Sir Joseph has always had the interests of the colony very much at heart. It was largely his influence that brought it into being, you'll recall. Then why did he refuse to receive MacArthur?" "I cannot suppose that he thought a man with Captain MacArthur's antecedents a desirable acquaintance," said Stephen, in a silence broken only by Colonel Macpherson's long, continuing, even-toned account of the Nawab of Oude. "Furthermore, Sir Joseph strongly objects to duels on moral grounds, and Captain MacArthur was in London to be court-martialed for engaging in one." Lowe didn't seem to hear the later words. At the first he flushed a dull red, and he said no more until the end of the meal, only muttering, "Undesirable acquaintance," from time to time, much as Stephen muttered within himself, "God give me patience, dear mother of God, give me patience." For the railing about Irish prisoners had begun again, as tedious as the railing of European women about domestic servants, but infinitely more malignant. By the time they retired for tea and coffee, Stephen had, in spite of his deliberate abstraction, heard as much as he could bear. There was a pressure of contained anger that made his hand tremble so that the coffee spilt into its saucer. Yet now came a pleasant interlude. He walked on the drawing-room terrace, smoking a cigar and talking to two well-read, interesting, Gaelic-speaking Hebridean officers of the 73rd, and the tension diminished somewhat. He and Pullings took their leave of Colonel Macpherson, and while the Colonel kept Pullings back to tell him that he was sorry Captain Aubrey hadn't been able to come, that although he had official letters for him, they couldn't be given into any hands but his own, and that he would be well advised to take a couple of pints of rice water, just lukewarm, Stephen walked into the narrow room where the officers put on their swords. There were few left, Tom's regulation lion-headed affair, three with basket hilts belonging to the Highlanders, and his own. He buckled it on and walked down the steps into pleasant freshness. And standing there on the gravel, he saw Captain Lowe, who said to him, "I don't give a bugger for Joe Banks, and I don't give a bugger for you either, you half-baked sod of a ship's surgeon." He spoke very loud and hoarse, and two or three officers turned. Stephen looked at him attentively. The man was in a choking rage, but he was perfectly steady on his feet. He wasn't drunk. "Will you answer for that, sir?" he asked. "There's my answer," said the big man with a blow that knocked Stephen's wig from his head. Stephen leapt back, whipped out his sword and cried, "Draw, man, draw, or I shall stick you like a hog." Lowe unsheathed his sabre. Little good did it do him. In two hissing passes, his right thigh was ploughed up. At the third, Stephen's sword was through his shoulder, and at the issue of a confused struggle at close quarters, he was flat on his back, Stephen's foot on his chest, Stephen's sword point at his throat, and the cold voice saying above him, "Ask my pardon, or you are a dead man. Ask my pardon, I say, or you are a dead man. A dead man." "I ask your pardon," said Lowe, and his eyes filled with blood.